gentlemen, welcome back. This is Red Ice Radio. I'm Henrik, wherever you are around the world, whether you are friend or foe, and concerned, like me, about the survival of European identity or not, I do hope that you care about true diversity and want to preserve it. We live in a world today where soulless materialism, empty consumer-driven globalism, and endless migration is threatening to displace and eradicate the uniqueness and the beauty of the European people. Now, Sweden, where I'm from, is being ruined, as I hope you've realized by now, by a pipe dream, by politicians and internationalists who themselves never live in the neighborhoods that they claim we will benefit so greatly from. This contrived oneness that they are enforcing is actually leading to division, alienation, terrorism, displacement, and unspeakable horrors of sexual assaults and violence and rape. It's time to wake up and realize that this version that they are pushing on us is actually not working. If you are new to the show, definitely check out the website redeyes.tv. Beyond the radio shows, we do live TV shows, we publish news, and we have a members' website filled with our entire archives, plus our live show, Weekend Warrior, that we do almost every Saturday. So sign up if you like the show, get access to all our material, and help us grow. Well, today we have a special show for you with Germar Rudolph. He joins us to share the story of his life's work as a revisionist researcher and writer, and the ostracizing and persecution he has endured for daring to tread into the controversial topic of the Holocaust. The few times I've not made long disclaimers before shows like this, I've lost newcomers, and that's not a very smart move. I simply usually urge people to use their mind and to open their mind. We are going to be treading into a forbidden zone where so many of us never go, ever, not even truth seekers and those passionate about history. So many comply, like good little Pavlovian dogs. They respond to the conditioning perfectly, to a T, without ever asking themselves why they react the way they do when we violate this greatest taboo, even for free speech advocates. They say here, but no further. When speaking about World War II and related subjects, I always want to give a perfect preface, you know, to entice you and dare you, urge you to follow along in an exercise that many people never do in their entire lives without ever knowing why. You know, in many countries, the governments have built a legal perimeter around this subject. It's a no-go zone, a strictly forbidden, enforced no-go zone. And I ask you why that is. And out of, you know, 1,000-plus shows that we have done over a 10-year period, we have done maybe 7 or 8 radio shows in total dedicated to this sensitive and emotionally charged subject. That's only, what, about 0.8% of all the things that we've discussed on this show. Yet this alone grants us to be banned from iTunes and many previous guests to completely turn their back on everything that we do, for simply daring to question a historical event and come to a different conclusion than the globalists are pushing on us. You know, I always encourage newcomers to listen to the other side, the side that they never share with you, and look at some of the research and professionally made videos and other material that we link up as companions to shows like this to help you along in not only daring to take the plunge, but also to realize that there truly is something fishy here, something that they are covering up, something that they don't want you to know about. You know, this, if nothing else, is a story of free speech and how the government has enforced restrictions on it, tight restrictions. In fact, restrictions that will land you in jail in certain European countries. And reasonably, everyone who's concerned with social justice, this should be a concern of them, right? Why should people who have a divergent opinion be treated any different, right? According to their own standards. So, you know, there's 1,000 things I could say. There is 1,000 things I could go through and motivate. But ultimately, it is up to you if you have interest at all in history and if you have the brains to understand the weight of this topic and why it's so important to look at it in greater detail, considering how the survival of the European people is hinged on the subject of the Holocaust and Nazism. So Germar Rudolph was born in Limburg, Germany. He studied chemistry at Bonn University, where he graduated in 1989 as a diplôme chemist, which is comparable to a U.S. PhD degree. From 1990 to 1993, he prepared a German PhD thesis at the Max Planck Institute for Solid State Research in conjunction with the University of Stuttgart. Parallel to this, and in his spare time, Rudolph prepared an expert report on chemical and technical questions of the alleged gas chamber of Auschwitz, the Rudolph Report. He is the founder of the revisionist outlet Castle Hill Publishers. Please stay tuned and please listen what Germar has to say. Welcome to the program, Germar. It's a pleasure to finally have you with us. I've been an admirer of your work for many years, so it's a pleasure for me to have you here on the show.
It's a pleasure for me to be on the show.
Excellent. Now, let's dive into this here. This is a big topic we're going to discuss today. It's a controversial topic, obviously. It's a topic that many people never really dare to tread into for various reasons, actually. But I'm curious to hear a bit about your background and your interest in this topic, Germar, and why you decided to spend your time and looking into an area which, of course, is at this day and age criminalized in many European countries. Tell us a bit about your background.
Well, I'm a German citizen, and I had, in school, I had to deal with the Holocaust three times because I changed schools, and then I changed around my topics a little bit, and in order to graduate, you had to have a minimum of history in school. I didn't have that, so I had to take more history classes, and then Holocaust came up again. So three times I was fed it until I was fed up. As a student, I was actually appreciative of that topic. Since as a German, it's kind of getting you in a bad mood. It's very unpleasant for Germans because we are perceive ourselves in this situation, of course, as descendants of the perpetrators, and it's also bad and dark what happened during the Holocaust and during the Second World War. That it kind of drives you away from wanting to hear anything about it, wanting to hear anything about the more recent German history that has led up to this. And so I was kind of deterred from it initially coming out of school, actually. I didn't want to have anything to do with it. But on the other hand, I was always interested in German identity, in German history, apart from this topic. So I would go up to the First World War and then kind of quit and skip over to the Federal Republic and all the mess of the Weimar Republic running up to the Third Reich. The Third Reich I would just keep at arm's length. And that changed a little bit while I was studying. I was studying at Bonn University chemistry, and during my spare time, I was reading a lot of history, politics, philosophy, just a broad range of interests I had, trying to understand things. And at that time, I was more and more, also because I happened to become a member in a student fraternity that was emphasizing patriotism, German identity, that I got interested in these questions. And I realized, and particularly in an environment where students dominate, that national identity issues and patriotism has such a negative image, such a negative connotations for intellectuals in Germany, for young intellectuals, for students, that you are immediately in an extreme minority as a student if you insist that having an identity, having a cultural heritage and taking care of it is something good. You're isolated. You're getting even attacked. I mean, I was not a member of any group or any movement outside of what was considered socially acceptable back then. So I was still a part of the German Christian Democratic Union, the German party that's currently is ruling Germany. And considered myself more or less mainstream from that point of view, but living it inside a left-wing environment of students, what gave me completely different feeling. I was attacked back then. Some people actually drew swastikas on announcements that are put up on a blackboard announcing some or some event that my fraternity was doing. So I quickly became aware that even insisting on that there is a German identity and that it's worth preserving is something that it gets you a lot of hostility in Germany, and the reason I figured out is because of the Third Reich and all the bad things that happened there. So I was aware of it, but that didn't make me tread into this minefield of history. And that changed actually by accident, I would say. I was trying to convince other students that trying to get Germany to reunite. At that point, we're talking about the mid-80s, late 80s when I was studying. Germany was still divided. That was communist Central Germany and democratic, quote-unquote, West Germany. I insisted on Germany should get reunited and we should get going on that. And I read books on what's gone on in the Soviet Union, the weakening, the economic collapse that some were predicting. And I was reading these books and said, it's time to do something about it. Well, as the mainstream was going the opposite way, even the Conservative Party was eyeing the option of recognizing communist East Germany as a separate country, which West Germany had not done so at that point. And then, of course, we all know what happened. The Soviet Union collapsed. Germany suddenly got reunited, and there was a little patriotic party, the Republicans. They call themselves, they're still around, but now they're completely marginalized. And they were trying to rekindle patriotism, German identity, and then a little bit more acceptable right-wing politics, like the Alternative for Germany, the new party, is doing right now. So 20 years later, kind of the same constellation.
Right. Yeah.
And the same thing happened back then that happens with them now. They are being completely ostracized and persecuted, and the media just go on a campaign to destroy the party. So history repeats itself. When I look at what's going on in Germany now, so we had the same thing 25 years ago. I was a member of that party, and I had to experience all, even though that was the only party sticking to the constitutional demand of fighting for the reunification of Germany. They were the ones, when it actually happened, they were persecuted and marginalized and ostracized. And that upset me, but I again recognized the mechanism, particularly in Germany. Later on, I learned it's not much different in another European country how that works, that any identity group, European identity movement, gets destroyed and ostracized by ultimately putting out the gas chambers.
Right.
Anyone saying that if you want to have your own national way, you want to be proud of yourself, that means that in the long run, down the road, you put the others in the gas chambers.
Right.
you don't like the Turks in Germany. I remember in 1989, after the Republicans in Germany had their first electoral victory in early 89, I think it was, in Berlin, and the leader of the party there was asked by a journalist, well, what are you going to do with the Turks? Are you going to shove them into gas chambers? And that's broke for me, and I said, I don't believe it. They do it over and over, and it was so blunt and so brutal and so obvious that this gas chamber weapon, this Holocaust weapon, is used by the media, by anything on the left wing, by anything standing for globalism, internationalism, multicultural, whatever you call it, to destroy anything that tries to preserve identity, to maintain identity, what have you. But only in the European context. You know, the left wing Shikaria in Germany, they are always happy to embrace Amazon Indians or Tibet Asians when they are struggling for their national identity.
Of course,
that's fashionable because they are not white, they're not Europeans. And even when in South Africa now the shoe is on the other foot and blacks persecute whites and kill them and whatever is going on there in detail. I don't know a little bit what's going on. But nobody talks about it. It's a reverse situation as it was under apartheid regime to some degree. But black racism, and you can see that here in this country, everybody talks about racism when there was again a shooting. But I wonder, you know, the big elephant in the room is that white racism is not acceptable, or racial identity, or any identity. It doesn't even have to be based on race. It can be on culture. It can be on whatever you want to call it. It's not acceptable if white folks, European folks, start with it, but if a black ghetto group here in the United States makes racist remarks or has a racist attitude, that's not talked about.
That's right.
And the same in South Africa. Black racism goes around. I can understand historically why they would have that attitude because we've been suppressed for so long. And there's always a reason why people do things, and sometimes it's understandable reason, but it's never a justification. So I saw these links, and it just took a an accidental encounter with credible arguments by credible individuals that made me look into what I had avoided all these, well, the first two decades of my life, let's say, or two and a half, 3 decades, looking to the Holocaust without the facts claimed about it. And that was, I accidentally stumbled over the Lichter Report, the most famous or infamous Lichter Report, depending on how you look at it. So the American expert for execution technologies, since they have the death penalty here in the U.S., they have to have some experts who maintain the equipment with which the capital punishment is executed. And the one guy who was doing it back in the late 80s was asked by a defense team up in Canada, of a Canadian German who was on trial for quote-unquote Holocaust denial. He was asked to write an expert report and to testify in court as to whether or not the facilities in two camps, in Auschwitz and Majdanek camp in Poland, as they either exist today or as they can be understood from blueprints that are available, whether these facilities would have been able to commit the mass murder as is claimed by historians or witnesses. So he did that in 88. He submitted his report in February that year. And I found out about it a little over a year later by a Swiss political scientist who was writing about the use and abuse of terms of the past in Germany, which is a big issue in Germany. Third Reich history is being used and abused in politics to destroy opponents, competitors, and to marginalize groups and individuals. We see that now again in the Alternative for Germany, but it goes like a red thread through German history after the Second World War.
Yeah.
And he has been writing about it, analyzing it, and in a new edition of that book that came out in 89, he wrote about the Lichter Report and said, well, what would happen if somebody comes up and says, well, I made an expert report, I investigated the murder weapon. If somebody did that with the claimed murder weapon for the French Revolution, that is the guillotine, and he comes up, well, I think the claims about how it is supposed to have functioned, how many people were murdered with it, and all this, this is wrong, this is atrocity propaganda put out by royalists who were trying to blacken the image of the revolutionaries.
Right.
And I said, well, it would be a controversial thesis, and historians would organize conferences, would discuss the arguments and would either refute it or would not be able to refute it, and would maybe have to adjust the history books to take into consideration the new evidence, and that would be pretty much about it. And objectively seeing, that should be the same here, even though time-wise it's much closer, and we're talking about more victims. But in theory, it's a historical, it's a factual question, it's a question of that it should be open to scientific investigation. And if an expert comes up with a theory, no, the gas chambers, as they are claimed, they couldn't have worked, and what I've seen there, that was not equipped in a way that would have functioned as claimed. That's what Lucia did. But, of course, nothing like an objective discussion of his thesis ever happened. There was, again, just marginalization, ostracism, and persecution that he had to go through. When I read about this, I didn't know about the persecution yet. Would have probably prevented me from getting into it.
You think so?
But I don't know. I mean, I wasn't. I have, my personality is a little bit of a contrarian in nature, I would say. So if I perceive something to be unjust, persecution to be unjust, to be unfair, not warranted, or just plain wrong, I have a tendency to stand up against it and to fight against it.
Right.
In general, I mean, I have a history. You can ask my mother. She says I have an overdeveloped sense for justice. And I think it's a problem because your concept of justice is still very skewed and very subjective and egocentric. But as you mature, you get more and more a wider perspective and you can objectivize this. But my attitude hasn't changed. If I perceive something as unjust, I just won't take it.
Yeah.
And in this regard, too, I mean, I found out then about persecution of revisionists on a scale that I had not considered possible, and it hasn't deterred me. It has made me more angry and more determined. Now, the same has happened with my own persecution. A lot of people around me, friends and my first wife, too, they at some point they've had it, and they disassociate or divorce in the case of the first wife. But that's not what I do. I don't shrink away from the challenge. I grow with the challenge. So one factor was definitely seeing the persecution going on. There's no rational discussion. If somebody has an argument, it should be listened to. It should be verified or falsified. And
of course.
In way, and you shouldn't just call for the prosecutor and throw people into prison. And today it's come to the point where you're not even allowed to muster a defense in courtroom, because if you try to in the courtroom to prove that you're right, what you did do in the eyes of the court is denying again in the courtroom, and you're using the public stage of the courtroom to spread your propaganda.
So right.
Another offense, and then you get another indictment, another case. So if he just dares to file a motion to introduce evidence, just filing the motion can get a lawyer in prison. Nowadays.
Wow, really?
And I have two of my lawyers that, I ended up being an expert report similar to Leister, writing an expert report, showing up in courtrooms on the request of defense lawyers. And the things I had to experience there, how judges violate the law in an attempt to prevent me from testifying, was eye-opening and made me even more angry to see how the system breaks its own rules, its own laws, to keep up that taboo and to prevent anyone from speaking up against it or from presenting any factual evidence.
Yeah.
Mine was purely engineering and chemical in nature. There was, as such, not history and no politics in it at all. It was just forensics. And that's what every crime should be subjected to. I just had a written interview with Jonas Alexis from Veterans Today. What we're dealing with here, we're talking about one of the biggest crimes of the history of mankind, as it is claimed. So the mass slaughter of 3 million plus people in chemical slaughterhouses called gas chambers, and several million more just shot or starved to death for other reasons, other ways they died. So we are talking about a massive crime, and whether a crime is little, if it's just one person killed or raped or injured, or whether it's 6 million that have died, it's still a crime that should be subjected to the same standard of investigation. But it's completely politicized, and any critical investigation that ends up coming to unwanted conclusions gets just brutally suppressed. And then the name calling started against me too. I just had a remark by someone from the other side saying, "Well, look at this denier and anti-Semite and racist talking," meaning talking about me. Say. And I say I was persecuted and prosecuted for my scholarly writings, for my expert report on Auschwitz investigating chemical issues. I was sentenced eventually to 14 months in prison without being allowed to present evidence for the fact that my arguments are correct. And later on,
tell the audience when that was, by the way, so we get an idea of the time frame here.
Well, I found out about the Leuchter report in 1989. In 91, I wrote a letter to the editor saying, well, I'm not convinced, I'm not convinced that the Leuchter report is the final word because there are holes in the arguments and some flawed arguments, and that should be a better job should be done on it. I got contacted. I asked, can you do that? Can you write an expert report? And I agreed because I was happy. It was exciting. At that time, I was doing my PhD in a ivory tower topic that was kind of boring because it had no application to real life, but this one was so real it can't get any more real, more relevant, because obviously nations, the whole world in the United Nations are out to suppress any consent in this context. There's just no other topic where persecution and the will of authorities to suppress any dissent is so massive as in this area. So that was clear evidence for me right there, no matter what you think about any politics of identity and what have you, for the authorities, for the powers to be, that is the most important. So I just dig in and that's it. And I decided to do it because it was just made sense. There was nothing more that made more sense to me than going for this topic and trying to thoroughly investigate it. I wrote the report in 91, early 92, and it got submitted to various courts, so 7-8 court cases in the years between 91 and 94. And I got then the criminal investigation started in 93 when my expert report was published together with a preface and an appendix by the guy who actually published it. And they used that because it was polemical in nature. It was attacking historians, politicians, and judges for suppressing the debate and for letting people go in prison without giving them a chance to defend themselves. So that it was considered polemics. And therefore, the court that actually sentenced me for that expert report says you can't claim scientific freedom because of the preface, which is not scientific, and that all expert report unscientific, even though it is a preface that was written by somebody else and not even by me. I didn't even know that he had edited it. I found out when they started distributing it.
Right.
Either as it may, I got then in 95 sentenced to 14 months in prison for that, and but it was going through revision procedure, and finally the case was settled in 96. I was not taken into custody because they considered it unlikely that I would flee, but I did then. Before the final judgment by the higher court was handed down, I left the country, so I didn't serve those 14 months, went to England instead in 96, and started a revisionist publishing company, just basically turning my passion into a profession. So what the German authorities tried to do to stop me from doing, then I was doing it 24/7 because all bridges were burnt and I had nothing else left to do, and I dedicated my life, so to say, to that. And it has been that way ever since. Now, eventually, things got bad in England. I wasn't sure whether England would extradite me or not. A lawyer that I had then would say I stand no chance if Germany asks for extradition. They were doing that in late 99. If the authorities catch me in England, they would just hand me over without further ado, and I decided to leave the country. I went to the United States and eventually applied for a political asylum in the United States, which at the end didn't go much of anywhere because the United States has waged two wars against Germany to get Germany to do what it's doing now, that is self-destruction. And they're not going to revert that by giving me, who is giving Germans and Europeans in general, a tool, a scientific, historical tool that can be used politically to stop that self-destruction of the entire European civilization that's currently going on. Any identity movement needs to be able to withstand accusation of racism and intentions of mass murder, because that's what basically comes up each time you want to preserve the Swedish identity, the German identity, any European identity against what's going on, what has been going on for the past decades. And this.
Well, and that too, Germar, that proves that this is a weapon, really, that is being used against us, which makes it one of the most important questions that we need to address and face if we are going to muster up the courage, if you will, to try to prevent what we're seeing happening today. Would you agree with that?
Yeah. The Germans have the term Wunderwaffe, the miracle weapon. And that is, Germany had none in the Second World War, but Germany's enemies, or Europe's enemies, have it now, and that is the Holocaust propaganda, which is used to beat down psychologically everyone who resists anything that the powers be want to implement. And people are aware that this is such a powerful weapon, such a dangerous weapon that most people are terribly afraid of it and try to stay away, far away from it as they can. And I can understand that if you have the liberty to dodge a weapon, to get out of the way and not to face it, and it's not doing any harm to you, then it's fine to do that. The problem is you cannot avoid it. It is like you are besieged by the enemy. You are in a small castle, so to say. You're surrounded by the enemy. They're all aiming that miracle weapon at you, and you can't dodge it. It is destroying the castle, the walls, step by step, bit by bit, and you can pipe dream that just looking away, sticking the hand in the head in the sand is making it go away. Play the infamous three apes: close your eyes, close your ears, close your mouth, but that's not going away. If you want to achieve anything in regards to standing up against the authorities, then you have to face that. And the absolute proof for it is the fact that for the powers that be, particularly in Europe, nothing is more important when it comes to discussing anything than suppressing Holocaust dissent, because it's the only topic in the world, in the history of mankind, when it comes to history, that has ever been chiseled in stone by penal law and where dissent is mercilessly prosecuted and persecuted. That is the only real unique thing about the Holocaust, is the persecution and prosecution of dissidents. There have always been massacres, there have always been genocides, there are many cases where millions and millions of people died and where high percentages of ethnic groups were killed. Nothing of it, when we're talking about technologies, the Holocaust was highly technological. If you actually look into the fact, it was not. The claims of highly technological are ridiculous. If you look into what the eyewitness claimed, that it was so primitive that you say if the German really had intended to do something like that, they would have, as the technologically leading nation back then, they would have used different solutions than what's claimed, which isn't even technically possible at times. But that's a different issue. So the really only unique thing about the Holocaust is the persecution of dissidents. And that shows you already that something must be fishy with the whole thing. And that's the Achilles heel of the powers that be. And they know it, and that's why they persecute anyone so mercilessly, because they know once that breaks through, once a broader broader percentage of the normal populace finds out about the real arguments of revisionists, how logical, how self-evident they are, and how convincing they are. Well, once enough people lose the fear because they are angry enough, a lot of people, when they find out how they've been lied to and cheated to about this, when they first see some really convincing arguments, they get really angry.
Yes.
And they don't care anymore about persecution. Now, if you get a critical mass of people, you don't need an awful lot, just a certain critical mass that starts a snowball rolling down the hill, then they lose control, and they know it, and that's why they are so merciless with the persecution.
And also, let me add, Germar, that, you know, this topic, this issue that is occurring right now with this historical event, this is really the spearhead of free speech right here as well, and all those that are supposedly free speech advocates, as we know, many of them never stand up in defense of people who are subjected to the kind of persecution that you've been talking about. In many cases, of course, it's been very successful of them to paint many of these people who question this historical event as being somehow almost lunatics, right? That there's a mental problem with these people, just because of the fact that you dare to question this event. So it's almost like a preemptive strategy that has been put in place, where you're not even supposed to get to the point where you look at some of the material of this, right?
Right. That is the effect of 70 years of propaganda, making everyone think everything is so obvious and so well proven. How could anyone be so deluded to doubt any of this? And of course, most everybody who talks that way has not even a basic knowledge about the Holocaust, apart from knowing the name of Auschwitz and Zyklon B, maybe. But these are the less people know, sometimes I get the impression the less people know, the more dogmatic they are about it.
That's right.
Issue. And it is so easy to actually, in a debate with them, to get them to lose footage on the factual basis because they don't know what they're talking about, that they instantly switch over to ad hominem attack, to accusations of the usual stuff, Nazi, extremist, anti-Semite, and whatever, else that has nothing to do with the debate whatsoever. And sometimes it gets ludicrous because there are some people who have a Jewish heritage who are revisionists, and when they start calling those people anti-Semites, you know, it gets ridiculous. But even that works for some people. Jewish anti-Semite? How does that work? Seraphating Jew, whatever.
Right.
I found it edifying. I found it encouraging, funny at times, to how easy it is to get the system to panic. I saw that I was back then doing my PhD at the Max Planck Institute, appearing in front of a court with my chemical research, and the system was panicking. The judges were suddenly, in the middle of it, without any reason, interrupt the proceedings, run out of the courtroom to get instructions on how to handle the situation, because if an expert witness is present in the courtroom, it can, by German law, procedural law, expert witness cannot be denied to testify. Hmm. If he's indeed an expert, and I had a diploma degree in chemistry, and I was going for a PhD in Max Planck Institute, that is recognized as in sufficient expertise to testify as an expert witness. So I was an expert witness. I was an expert. I testified on a topic that was pertinent to the case, and I was present in the courtroom. They could not deny me to testify, and yet after getting instructions, that is to say, cover my ass, phone call to higher up judges or whatever, the judges came back and broke the law and denied me to testify. So I've seen how they panic, what tricks they pull off their sleeves to uphold this illusion, and that shores up the whole system. So it's just one little guy who makes the whole system panic, and I've seen that again and again. You know, if you look how many actively researching and publishing revisionists there are in the world, Italy just introduced a Holocaust denial law a couple of weeks ago.
Oh, really? Yeah, because I looked at a map and I saw that Italy was not on that map of having these laws. So that's changed now, huh?
The map has outdated. The map was drawn half a year ago, and now just a month ago, as I think it's relatively fresh, they introduced it. And in Italy, you have one person who is publishing and researching. It's just one. So they introduce a law to prevent this one person from doing what he's doing and threatening him with 3 years in jail. When there are always bloggers and people who comment or sympathize and support the guy, but that's not the issue. The real danger comes from the people who do the research and bring up the convincing evidence and show up courtrooms and get the system into trouble because, you know, oh, we have free speech and we are nations under the rule of law and we abide to the law and the authorities have to follow the law too. But if then push comes to shove and you experience it yourself, they give a damn about the law. They break it as they need to uphold this whole thing.
Which would mean that, in that case, when you were involved and the judges just changed things on the fly like that, that means that they individually are, I mean, obviously they would be prepped before a case like this, but someone is directing them to make sure that a desired outcome is the end result of something like this, correct?
Yes. I mean, there were precedent cases in Germany. If a judge tried to be accommodating to any kind of defense strategy along that line, the judge can be prosecuted. So the judge is putting his career on his line and even his freedom if he dares follow the law by allowing evidence. Now, they have changed the law now. Now it is actually that you are not allowed to introduce any evidence, as I just earlier mentioned. Back when I was appearing in court, that wasn't the case yet. They could still file motions and they couldn't prosecute, but they have changed that then because actually of what I was doing back in those years. And lawyers, they started prosecuting lawyers, and there was no case law or written law to prosecute lawyers just for filing a motion to introduce evidence. But the case law was then created for on occasion of two lawyers who had filed motions to introduce me as an expert witness. And at the end of it, filing such motions has now been factually outlawed. So that's one of my achievements in the system, too.
Well, very, very well, very well done. Let's just give a little bit of time here to the audience that are listening, and the newcomer who's listening, and people who, might be at a point where they basically have never looked at any of this material. They might be listening because they're intrigued with your story of suppression and active, how the system has been working against you, just what you've been talking about. But can you describe a little bit of what actually a revisionist is as opposed to what it is not? I mean, because usually what happens, as you said, that you get a kind of a straw man. They set up a lie, basically, of what it is that you represent when you start going into these topics. But what would you say really is the case? What are really some of the questions and points that you and others like you are trying to lift forward and highlight?
Well, revisionism is a broad term, and we should now limit it maybe to, first of all, Holocaust revisionism, and we should limit it also to those who actually do the research, do the actual publication, get the knowledge together. There are always people who use material that we put out that have their own agenda, and those then get used to at times blame it back on the revisionists if there's some racist or some actual anti-Semitism and neo-Nazi, and these people do exist, then they come up and use their material to push for their own agenda. That happens to every idea you put out there can be abused by somebody. And that's where those false claims come to. Do you take a neo-Nazi and claim he's a revisionist? No, it was the other way. He's a neo-Nazi and he uses revisionist arguments or abuses them. So let's get something straight. What the media tell revisionists are, which is a lie, they are very broad terms like, well, revisionists deny that Jews were persecuted, which we don't. That's an undeniable fact. During the Third Reich, Jews were persecuted. They were deprived of their civil rights. They were deported. They were herded into ghettos. They were put into concentration camps. And they were put to forced labor in the concentration camps. Yes, there were crematoria where the corpses of those who had died were incinerated. And there's no doubt that Jews died in great numbers for many reasons in the camps, in the ghettos, for epidemics, malnutrition, disease, even mistreatment. And all this is not denied. Furthermore, there is no denying that other minorities were at times persecuted too, like gypsies or political dissidents. Now, the extent of how many died and who died for what reasons is then again a topic of discussion. But the general issue that what happened with all the persecution and going on, that is not denied by revisionists. Furthermore, on the moral level, we need to get that out of the way. Revisionists don't say, if you're really serious, you don't say that the treatment of the Jews was just. If you put a minority just because a person belongs to a certain group, you start persecuting them, mistreating them, that's not justifiable. Now, some people out there might do it and say, well, the Jews have done this and that, and therefore they know. That's not the way you can argue. If some Jew did something, and you can hold this personal Jew responsible, but you can't hold Jews as a group responsible for something only some of them did. So do we deny the victim's dignity? No. Do we want to wipe out the memory of these victims? No. We want victims to be remembered. Not just Jewish victims, all the victims of violence, of persecution, of wars and atrocities. Do we deny showing compassion to these victims? No. Somebody is a victim. There were a lot of victims for a number of reasons, and compassion is always due. Do we deny that there was a systematic plan by the National Socialist government enacted by technological means, in terms of homicidal gas chambers to kill as many Jews as possible, ending up with a total death toll of 6 million, that is put into question.
Yes.
So it's not about all the persecution that happened, about the many victims that died as a consequence of that, and that all this was unjust and bad. This is not denied. What we're talking about is only, was there a plan to systematically wipe off the earth the Jews that the Nazis could lay their hands on, primarily by means of chemical slaughterhouses called gas chambers? And is it a death toll at the end, plus minus 6 million? These are the questions. And I got into it by very specifically asking in Auschwitz the places that claimed to have been homicidal gas chambers, were they or were they not? I wasn't asking about, did Auschwitz exist? That's ridiculous to ask. You know? Did Hiroshima exist? Did Washington exist? No, that's a stupid question. Yeah, of course, Auschwitz existed. It was a concentration camp. It had disastrous hygienic conditions. Epidemic broke out at some point in the summer and fall of 1942. Hundreds of people every day died because of typhus epidemic. And for the only person who was responsible there is the leadership of the German Reich, who decided to send all these people in the camp that wasn't prepared to receive them. Now, to do that, you put people for no reasons other than they belong to a group in a camp, and you can't feed them and you can't keep them healthy. That's your responsibility. There's no doubt about it. But was there actually a gas chamber in that camp that was used to kill up to 1 million people? The death toll that is accepted by revisionists in Auschwitz lies a little bit over 100,000. Now, you have one wartime camp, and 100,000 people within just 3 or 4 years die in that camp. Can you imagine that?
Yep.
Bad, awful, terrible conditions. Over 100,000 people. It's bad news, but it's better news than having 1 million people being slaughtered in a chemical slaughterhouse.
Right.
Just because I say, well, this is the truth, 120,000 died because of bad conditions that the Germans were responsible for because they just didn't handle the situation properly, that makes me then a denier and a bad person, and because I contest that there was a chemical slaughterhouse, and I have a zillion of arguments why there couldn't have been a chemical slaughterhouse to begin with, because the typhus epidemic were raging there so badly at the time when those exterminations are said to have happened at that time, for infrastructural reasons, for technological reasons, for a number of reasons, the Germans wouldn't have been able to handle even more dead people than they already had at their hands because of those epidemics that were raging, apart from the fact that all the technology, all the forensic evidence, all the documents clearly indicate there was no such thing. It's just made up. And we have now consistent evidence of systematic torture of people under British and American and Soviet custody after the war of former camp staff members.
Yep.
To extract from them testimonies, which by just looking at the testimonies and looking at how it could be technically possible what they claim, or does it hold water compared to the facts we know. We know already by what they stated and how they stated it that it can't be true. But knowing now by a book published by a British journalist just 10 years ago that the British and the Americans actually applied systematic torture. They got all these people from the former concentration camps, put them in these camps and tortured them by the hundreds systematically to get those confessions out of them. And that's what history is based upon. And then you look at the witnesses of those survivors, and you see a similar pattern of claims that are just as ludicrous, have nothing to do with reality, and are completely off the wall for the most part of those who are claimed as proof for. I mean, there are a lot of survivors, which in and of itself shows you that there was no system in it, because if you have 200,000 Auschwitz survivors, which we do have documentation about, 200,000, I think half of them or more than half of them are actually Jews. What kind of a systematic mass murder is it if 100,000 or 200,000 of them get away and are sent into the world to testify? No. But of these 200,000 that got out of the camp, maybe 500 or 1,000 got public with stories that are supposed to shore up gas chamber stories. So out of 200,000, you have just say 2,000. It's just 1%. And in a wartime situation of extreme emotion and extreme political propaganda, to have 1% of the survivors lie, exaggerate, make up stories, you have always 1% of the population that lies, exaggerated. This is normal. But you have the 199,000 that didn't do it.
Mm-hmm.
And all this taken together makes it very clear on the case of Auschwitz. And that's a very well-documented case because almost all the documentation about Auschwitz survived. Many other camps, they were destroyed by the Germans before they were run over by Allied, but not so in Auschwitz, not so in Majdanek. We have the documents there, and we can reconstruct almost every nail and every brick that was used in the camp to do this or to do that. Every pencil that was shoved from one side of the desk to the other is all recorded and documented, and we can reconstruct it day by day, and we see no such thing, no trace. They had other problems, massive problems, trying to man the armament factories with those workers. But then they had epidemics and the whole thing collapsed because most of the workers were unable to work because they died like flies, including the guards, the SS guards. They died.
Right. Yep.
By the hundreds there too because of typhus.
Yes, starvation. You had obviously two, you know, there was so many things that Germany was struggling with at the time as well. That eventually, specifically towards the end of the war, things just collapsed entirely. And that's where you also got starvation coming into the picture and these kinds of things. But I want to continue to talk more about the evidence that you have gathered and researched over the years in the second hour as we continue. But I want to spend about 4 or 5 minutes talking a bit about your latest book so people know about some of the material that you're working on and have available for people who want to find out more. It's called Resistance is Obligatory. Tell us a bit about the book and why you wanted to write this one.
As a matter of fact, when I was put into prison, eventually my asylum case in the United States went bad. They deported me to Germany, and there the police arrested me there at the gangway coming out of the plane and put me in the prison to serve my old 14 months for my expert report, and then they put me on trial for publications I had done in the meantime, and eventually sentenced me. Now, in the situation as I was there, I was not allowed to defend myself in the matter itself. I gave a 7-day lecture in court about what is revisionism, why is revisionism scholarly and scientific, and why is the mainstream historiography, the mainstream school of Holocaust research, so to say, why are they not scholarly? And why is it important to let scientists do their research freely, and what importance does it have for society? And then also, who is violating laws here? Is it me who is insisting on free speech, or is it the government that tries to suppress something with illicit methods or outright illegal methods? And then coming up to the point, what is a citizen to do when they see that the authorities violate the law to suppress civil rights and that they persecute dissidents, peaceful dissidents? And the conclusion was basically with all the theoretical work that has been done in the West during the years of peaceful resistance. You know, you have the most famous representative, Mahatma Gandhi. Everybody knows about him, about peaceful resistance. And that's where I also picked up and all the nice theories that the West has developed during the Cold War, when there was the peace movement opposing armament in general, or nuclear weapons in particular, or nuclear energy even in Germany, that battles going on in the 70s and 80s in the country, almost like civil war, where the peace movement was confronting the authorities, not very peacefully. And the theories that were developed then about when does a citizen have the right, or even the obligation, the moral obligation to resist authority. And they've clearly shown that in some cases, you know, if it's about minor laws, you're not allowed to do it. But when it's about major principles of civil rights, then resistance is obligatory. And that's what I come to the conclusion. A human is different from any other animal by its critical capacity. The way we go about to distinguish illusion from reality. An animal has impressions from its environment through its senses, but it can't do much about it. It just has to live with whatever the body tells it it's supposed to do. We can be critical, we can communicate with others, we can verify whether something is an illusion or an actual fact. And that scientific approach, that critical approach that is so unique to humans, that makes us humans. That's the base of our human dignity. It's not that we can have sex with what we want to, or can have eat with whom we want to. That's animal world. The human world is different from the animal world because we can be critical and can communicate critically. And if the government goes in and suppresses that very aspect of human life, they are suppressing human dignity, and that's the very most important thing in the German Constitution, human dignity. And the German government is trampling it into dust, not just free speech, but human dignity. You don't want to have the right to doubt. That is where every research, every critical thinking begins. I doubt my sensory input. And then I want to go about critically to find out what the truth is. And if the government denies me to do that, the government denies me my humanity, and then I have the obligation to resistance to the very end.
Right.
So I told the court that, here I am. I can do no other, like Martin Luther said, and do with me what we want, but I resist, period. So basically, that is what the book's about. It writes down my speech, my seven-day speech, and then gives an explanation, documentation about all the things that I said that I could not deliver in court, in the courtroom. And I wrote it actually while I was in prison. I tried to publish it while I was in prison, and I got another prosecution because, of course, during my trial, I was also defending myself against the accusations of that my writings are stirring up to hostile feelings and that they're inaccurate and whatever. And that part of my defense speech was then used by the prosecution, who intercepted my proofs going in and out of prison in preparation of the book. They interpreted that as my attempt to again deny and commit another crime, and they started prosecuting. Well, I had a good lawyer, and he managed to get that case shelved and went away. And I waited with publishing the book then until I was out of prison and out of the reach of the German authorities. But there it is. It came out just 4 years ago in the first edition. I wrote out in the second now.
Is that your latest work? I mean, I know you have several. You're also working, I think, with Eric Hunt a bit, video productions and things like this. Give us an overview of some of the things that you have available for people that want to find out more and really get the meat of your work, if you will.
Well, the central place to go if you want to find out about me and my work is my own personal website, which is gammarudolf.com. Rudolf with an F, not a PH. And I have a section where I introduce my views from very simple texts to more complex texts, which includes some of the things that I've published over the years. Also, at the end, has a list of all the publications that have come out. Now, that's when you want to approach it from finding out about me. Now, if you are interested in the topic as such, independent of my person, the best place to start is probably a website that's called holocausthandbooks.com, where the most up-to-date revisionist research and also the most concise introductions into the topic have been posted. They are both available for purchase as Kindle or as hard copy books, but most of them are actually available for free download, so you don't have to spend a penny. You go to this website, look what you think you want to have, and just download it. And then we have also documentaries that have come out over the years on that topic, so that's maybe the least committing and most entertaining way of getting your feet wet, so to say.
It's effective, though, I have to say. For the newcomer, for them to easily get an overview, because obviously, whether they appreciate history or not, this could be academically maybe a pretty hard topic, and emotionally a hard topic to get into. But these videos, I think, is very, very effectful to get the newcomers' eyes open to a world which has been hidden from them.
Right, I think so too. There are a number that they all approach the topic from a different angle. We don't have the one documentary that you should watch. There's a lot out there if you go to YouTube, but then that's a dumping ground for all kind of other trash too, so you need to be careful. We try to really limit it to the stuff that we can vouch for is accurate. I mean, sometimes a video is 10 years old and research goes on and not everything is necessarily 100% accurate anymore.
Sure.
But, for instance, we have released a documentary questioning the Holocaust, Why We Believed, which picks up from where most people are. You believe. Of course, why wouldn't you? Because everybody says, you have to, but everybody says it's so obvious because all historians agree, all politicians agree, all media agree, all the experts agree. How can you, as an amateur or as a complete novice, disagree? That would be insane. I mean, all the experts agree there's coming a thunderstorm around the corner. Why would you disagree? It's insane. So we all believe. Now, the question is, how do you get from that point to a different part in life? And this video, questioning the Holocaust, Why We Believed, eases you in by not going into the very extremes of the Holocaust, which is Auschwitz, Treblinka, the mass extermination camps, as they're claimed, but into minor issues where it can be easily shown how people get disinformed by media. And I'm saying disinformed. I'm not saying lied to, because rest assured, most journalists have been brainwashed their entire lives until they turn into professional journalists. They have their own beliefs. They have no reason to doubt. And there's no other section of the population that thinks they know it all and whose knowledge is actually so superficial, as it is the case for journalists. They have to cover so many topics in such a quick succession that this day they write about that day they write about that, the next minute they have to write about this, and always very concise, very brief. There is no way for them and no point in getting in-depth knowledge, because the time they have to invest to thoroughly research a topic they're writing about, the topic is gone by the time they're done. You do thorough research, it takes you a couple of weeks, but news events are a matter of minutes, hours, days at best.
Yeah.
So journalists live from day to day, from minute to minute, and whatever they report is just technite. It's just so superficial. But taking you from there, we all know Dachau was a bad place, a concentration camp, and when the Americans went in there, they found the corpses, and the same happened when they went to Nordhaus and they found all these mass corpses, and they recorded it, they banned it on film, and they showed it right after the war as proof for German atrocities. And Eric Hunt, the documentary maker, goes from there and then shows, with all the documentation and the fact available, that these are distorted, manipulated footages that actually, when we look into the documentation, into what really happened, prove something completely different than what the Allies claimed, and what is being repeated, has been repeated ever since, and it's being dished out to this day by the mass media, because the mass media, the journalists, don't know any better. And if there's one or two that do know it any better, they won't be employed very long anymore by the media they're looking for.
That's absolutely right, Germar. I want to take a break here now and then continue in the second hour and talk more about your work, your experiences. And also tie this in, as you kind of did in the beginning, you spoke a bit about what's happening in Europe right now, but I want to get your take on where Germany and Europe is in all of this in terms of what's happening right now. But I wanted to just give out the website here one more time. It's germarrudolf.com, Germar, RUDOLF.com. That's the website. And then you have holocausthandbooks.com. And we'll add a few videos to this program page as well that you definitely want to take a look at if you're a newcomer, if you've been you know, listening this far, give it a chance. You know, hear them out. Give look at it and see what you think for yourself. I think that this will open up a topic for you, which is remarkable when you when the pieces of the puzzle begins to fall in place. And as I said before, this really is the spearhead of free speech right now as well. There are many free speech activists out there who supposedly enjoy free speech and they push for it. They claim they're for it, but they would never touch a topic like this. The point is to try to get them to look at a topic like this, to make them understand that it's legitimate. These are very important. It's important for, as Germer said in the beginning, for identity, for reasons of the fact that it's being used against us as a weapon for us to erode our culture and all of these things that we're seeing happening in Europe and in America for that matter too. But we'll pick this up, Germer, in the second segment here, much more to get into. So stay with us, everybody. Stay with us, Germer. We'll take a short break and then we will be right back. Thank you so much for listening. Stay tuned for the second hour with Germer Rudolph, a very important and frankly frightening second hour as we discuss the coming demographic winter in Europe if current trends continue. We begin talking about the massive power structure upheaval that would need to occur in order for Western civilization at large to achieve a complete paradigm shift and accept the fact that we have been lied to and manipulated on so many levels concerning World War II and World War I. We talk about the establishment's grave fear of the rise of nationalism despite the recent terrorist attacks by foreign invaders in Germany, France, and all around Europe. And Germer gives a grim picture of the migration statistics from Europe, which is, you know, seeing many of its best and brightest fleeing Europe from the incoming population, the invasion, and they are taking up residence in other parts of the world. We discuss the most critical extinction-level crisis that is plaguing Europe right now, the demographic decline that is resulting from the shrinking birth rates. Germer emphasizes the financial implications of Europeans allowing themselves to be bred out like this, and we debate whether or not the government is disincentivizing or incentivizing having larger families is really the issue. We talk a bit about the 60s, sexual revolution, the advent of birth control, and also, of course, materialism itself. Very interesting continuation. Definitely don't miss it if you want to hear more. So the website is redeyesmembers.com. Sign up for a membership if you haven't already. It's only €6 per month. You can try it out for a three-month subscription, but we have memberships up to 2 years available. Support commercial-free and independent media. Thank you so much for listening, ladies and gentlemen. We'll be right back with the second hour. Stay tuned. We'll see you on the other side.